Thanks.
Thanks, Steve, for that generous introduction. So I can't believe begin to tell you what a pleasure it is to be back here. The campus looks totally different from what I remember as a student. But I think from the number of students that I spoke with this afternoon is that the spirit of Swarthmore still is the same, I think, as the spirit when I was a student, when I was sitting in your chairs. Steve really laid out the introduction of what I want to talk about. So this is really a culmination of just years of struggling of how to think about what has gone on in China. So perhaps the way that I'll start is that let me just start by just moving back in time 15 years. So this wasn't that long ago. I'm going to start in the 1998. Let me just show you some data on what the Chinese economy looked like in 1998. 1998, at least for researchers, is important because that is the first year in which one could get access to firm-level census data of Chinese firms. So it's really starting at that time that one can really begin to understand what is happening in China. So let me just show you some of the facts. So just, 1998 wasn't that long ago. I mean, I was still in graduate school in 1998. And the way I want to think about it is that if you look at the Chinese economy in 1998, nobody would have thought, at least certainly I did not think, that what would have happened in China is that at least 1998, I certainly did not think that what took place what eventually took place in China would happen. So if you look at the Chinese economy at that time, it was an economy that looked like it was in pretty desperate straits. It was dominated by state-owned firms. Just to give you a number, 60% of employment and investment, so this is from the firm-level records, was by state-owned firms. Private ownership was illegal for firms above a certain size, specifically for firms that are above the size of 70. If you want to hire more than 7 workers as a private firm, you couldn't do it. So you have to find some other creative way of trying to grow if you want to run a business. The state-owned firms that were dominant, they were largely these large, inefficient, money-losing dinosaurs. So just to give you some of the numbers, the average state-owned firm in that year had losses equivalent to about 8% of the value added of the firm. They were never closed, and they were kept alive through massive infusions of cash from the state banking system. But obviously what that did is that it basically just shifted the problem from the firms to the banks. So then they were left with the banking system that a huge that was just crippled with just a very large portfolio of non-performing loans. So the question then is, I guess one way in which you can begin to think about it is just to ask yourself, suppose that you were there in 1998. What would be the standard prescription? I would say that, this is probably my best guess of what Steve's prescription would be. And although he might not like it, it's also true that this would be the standard prescription around the lunch table at Chicago. At Chicago, which is that, what do you do when faced with this economic situation? The first thing you want to do is that obviously it makes no sense to restrict private ownership to firms that are small. So the first thing you want to do is that you want to remove the barriers that prevent private firms from growing. That seems to be a no-brainer. And the second thing that also seems to be a no-brainer is, what do you do with the large state-owned sector? Well, some of these firms you think are pretty hopeless. So the ones that are hopeless, you just want to shut these firms down. Okay, but some of them you think that might have some hope of making it. But we have a huge amount of evidence throughout history and also from all the countries of the world that politicians typically do a very bad job at running firms. So what you want to do is that you want to, to the extent that these are firms that you can save, you want to sell them off. You want to sell them off to people that have a vested interest in trying to make these firms run well. So the question then is this what happened in China? Okay. So the way I want to start this is to To begin to answer this question, I want to just go to this book, this fabulous book that's out by Dado Nasimoglu and Jim Robinson. So don't know whether it's on the syllabus of any class, but it's a book called Why Nations Fail. And it's a gutsy book, let me put it that way. So it's essentially a book that has one story, one explanation for 3,000 years of world history. And, you know, if you think about that, you know, that's pretty gutsy. It's pretty gutsy to think that you could have one story that would explain, you know, everything that has happened in the world in the last 3,000 years. But, you know, it's a pretty, but you know, what's lovely about the book, at least for me, is that it sort of walks you through some stories of what has happened in different regimes of the world and tries to, you know, tell this consistent story of, you know, when do states fail and when do states succeed. So what's lovely about the book is that, you know, everything I know about the rise and fall of the Roman Empire comes from this book, which, if any of you are scholars of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, my guess is that's going to be pretty sad. But there's a chapter on the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. There's a chapter on Venice. I love the chapter on Venice. There's a chapter on the Mayans, the chapter on the Aztecs. So the book really walks you through world history. And then in chapter 17 or 18 of the book, they get to China. And they tell the following story about China. And this is a story that they got from the correspondent of the Financial Times in Shanghai, this guy called Richard McGregor. And they tell the story of this one particular company called Jiangsu Tiebian Iron and Steel. It's actually an episode that's well known in China. So what is this firm? Okay, it's a private firm. It's a private firm, and this was a private firm that started up in the early 1990s. And this was the guy that ran a small steel plant. Okay, it was a relatively small steel plant. In the early 2000s, you know, he decided that he wanted to build the world's largest steel company, and he thought that he could do it. You know, he could have been crazy, but you know, as long as it's his money, what do I care? So what he did is that he went to the local government of this small city called Jiangzhou. It's a small city about up the Yangtze River from Shanghai, and this is what McGregor says about this guy. This is also in Asimoglu and Robinson. So he said, as a low-cost producer, he thought that he could easily grab a profitable market share away from the relatively pampered state-owned giants like Baosteel, 150 kilometers away down the Yangtze River near Shanghai. Keep this name in mind, the Baosteel company. So the way to think about what he was up against was that, you know, in the early 2000s in China, the steel industry was dominated by state-owned firms, okay? So if you're going to enter into a market, and if you turn out to be successful, then that other guy is going to be hurt. And that other guy then is not going to be that happy with the fact that you want to take away some of his profits. Well, the Asimoglu and Robinson's story is that consistently throughout world history, what has happened when these kind of situations happen is that companies like Baosteel manage to kill in some way. Or, you know, they may not kill, but they put tremendous barriers up to new firms, to firms that are threatening to take away their profits. But if you think about it, we think that it's precisely this process that drives economic growth. It's precisely this process in which, you know, Apple comes up with a new product and it looks like it's going to kill the BlackBerry. It's going to kill the BlackBerry. It looks like this Finnish firm Nokia is going to go to hell. Is going to happen. But You know, and although the guys at BlackBerry are not happy with this, although the guys at Nokia are not happy with this, presumably the world is better off as the consequence of the introduction of the iPhone. I mean, nobody talks about putting Steve Jobs in jail. At least not for this. At least not for this reason. You may want to put him in jail for other reasons. But what happened to this guy? Okay, this guy started to build in 2003. The guys at Baosteel were not happy, and this was the largest and the most powerful state-owned steel plant in China. So they were not happy. They put on pressure through the Chinese political system to try to get this firm shut down. So they were successful in doing so. So orders came down from the Communist Party to the banks to stop the lending. The local party secretary of this town was fired, and he was sent to supervise pig farms on the Russian border, which I presumably he was not happy about being reassigned. And on top of that, you know, they got this poor guy arrested and thrown in jail. So the poor guy spent 5 years in jail. So it seems clear, at least in this case, you know, what was the real crime of this guy? And it seems clear that, you know, what was going on is an age-old story. I mean, this is just a story that repeats itself again and again and again. That would, in this particular case, this guy had the audacity to start a company that would compete with state-sponsored companies, and in this case, Baosteel company. So what Baosteel did, you know, it's pretty sensible on their part, right? It's, you know, if you want to protect your profits, you can protect your profit by coming up with a better product, or you can do it by kneecapping your competitors. You know, both work. But both work in terms of protecting your profits, but one is good for welfare, overall welfare, and the other method is not. One would think it's not good for overall welfare. But the story that Asamoglu and Robinson take from this is that if you think about China within this broad sweep of world history, China is no different from other failed states. It's no different from any from this long history of states that have failed. That is, it is a state where vested interests are protected and entrepreneurs are blocked, okay? And then eventually the system is going to crumble. Let me just give you one more piece of evidence. This is sort of the same point that Steve made. You know, let's look at some indicators of the quality of the Chinese institutional environment. So one of the things, I would say probably the only thing that the World Bank does that countries pay attention to is these doing business indicators. So it's essentially the way to think about this is that these are sort of like the country equivalent of the U.S. News and World Reports. They have all these flaws, and then successful countries don't pay attention to them. But the countries that are, you know, that are ranked for 50, the same way that a college has ranked for 50, you can be sure that despite the fact that the college president says that we don't care about this thing, you know, he is watching this with an eagle eye. So I have seen finance ministers jump when these indicators come out. Okay, so let's look at how China does in these measures. So there's a summary statistic that's called the ease of doing business. It's essentially the weight average of all the different things that this survey measures. So China is ranked 91 out of 180 countries in the world. So it's about the same in terms of the ease of doing business as Guatemala and Zambia. Okay, so and it's significantly below the Peruvians, which is ranked 43, and below the Mexicans, which is ranked 43. A second indicator is the ease of entry. There's a typo there. It's not east. It's the ease of entry. And there, China ranks 151, which is actually lower than the Congo. The Congo is 150. Okay, and it's below the Iranians, which is 87, and the Pakistanis, which is an idea. So in China, people talk, you know, you go to China and there's this triumphalist tone of, you know, how many years is it going to take before China overtakes the U.S.? You know, nobody talks about how many years is it going to take for China to overcome the Iranians or the Pakistanis or the Peruvian. So the question number one, okay, is how? But see, you can see the tension here, right? Because if you look at all the indicators, and if I gave all this information to you and you didn't know that this was China, you would have been nodding your head and saying, you know, this country is an unadulterated economic disaster. But you know that from looking at the outcomes that this is a place where in the last 15 years, there's been the kind of growth in the private sector that we haven't seen anywhere else in the world. So I won't insult your intelligence by showing you the numbers, but I mean, this is something that you know from just looking in your pockets, from your pockets. So there's been this tremendous explosion of entry of new firms, and there's been this tremendous growth of the growth of the private sector as well. So the first thing that has happened in China, so you know, one first order fact, that there's been tremendous growth in the private sector. The second fact is what has happened to the state sector in China. Remember that we talked about how, you know, that the state sector was dominated by these large state-owned dinosaurs. So ask the question, well, what does the Chinese state sector look like now? So you can ask, you know, were the state-owned firms closed or privatized? As we think, we think that should have happened to these firms. And the answer is sort of, and I'll give you more details on what exactly it was that happened, but it's still the case that, you know, we sort of know that there's still a very significant presence of the Chinese state in the economy. So, you know, so there are lots of news accounts let me just give you, you know, so this cover page in the Business Week last year is representative. So there's an article, a cover story about how can America beat Chinese state capitalism? So what is this thing? What is Chinese state capitalism? I mean, nobody talks about, you know, how can America beat Indian state capitalism or Mexican state capitalism. So let me just give you another statistic. If you look at the Fortune 500 list last year, so this is the list of the 500 largest companies in the world. There are 69 Chinese companies on that list, and 65 of them, by my counting, are state-owned firms. Okay, so the largest Chinese firms are not private sector firms. The largest and the most the successful in terms of revenues and profits have been are state-owned firms. So I'm not making a welfare statement here. I'm just saying these are what the facts are. Okay, so in order to sort of get some sense of what has happened to the Chinese state-owned sector, before going into the story, let me just give you some more institutional details by just talking about one company, which is our old friend, the state-owned steel company. So this was the company that was featured in the Acemoglu and Robinson book. So what is this company? So this is the company its original name was Baoshan Iron and Steel. It's a company that's based in Shanghai. And it, you know, in the mid-1990s, it was your traditional state-owned dinosaur. It employed 150,000 workers. It was losing, on average, about $1 billion every year, billion U.S. Dollars every year. It was centrally controlled by the Chinese Ministry of Metallurgical Industry. So what happened to this firm? Okay, so what happened? So is that the Central Planning Ministry was closed in 2000, and Baoshan itself was legally closed in 1990. And then what happened at the same time is that a new company was created. Okay, so this new company was created. It was called Baoshan Company Limited, and then all of the assets of the old state-owned firm were transferred. So it's clear that the company was not closed. There was just a new legal entity was created to be the legal owner of the firm. And at the same time that this new firm was created, the firm was publicly listed. Okay? The firm was public listed, and this and since then, since the year 2000, this company has grown by leaps, has grown by leaps and bounds. So some of it is coming from handicapping its competitors. So it's clear that's an important part of what they do, but it seems that the company is no longer this old state-owned dinosaur. It's this aggressive state-owned firm. It's this really but the question is what is this firm? So it's a publicly traded firm. So this might look and smell like privatization. If a firm is publicly traded, we normally think of this as a firm that is private. And then in the Chinese statistical data, because the firm is registered as a publicly traded firm, it's listed in the statistical data as being a private firm. And my guess is that the Swarthmore's endowment owns something of this firm. Maybe they don't know it. Maybe they own it indirectly through a couple of hedge funds. But the question is, was this firm privatized? And the answer is sort of, kind of, because it's no longer this old central planning dinosaur. But let's dig deeper into the details of this firm. Okay, let's look at, so if you look at the details of this firm, right, 25% of the equity of the firm is traded. Okay, so if you're willing to spend a large amount of money, the maximum number of shares of this company that you could buy is 25% of the equity. So what that means is that you can never be the controlling shareholder of the firm. Okay? And 75% of the equity is held by this holding company called the Baosteel Group. Okay? And the Baosteel Group itself, so it's this holding company that also owns six or seven large steel manufacturers. And the Baosteel Group, and it's clear once you look at the details of this group that the chief executive of this group is directly appointed and evaluated by the Central Organization Department of the Chinese Communist Party. Okay? And so this is a very typical structure. So what is Chinese state capitalism? It's essentially firms like this, which is this weird mix of it's not quite a state-owned firm, but it is still a firm that these are typically firms that are publicly traded. These are firms that most of us own through our pension funds and through our endowment. But it is still a firm where the chief executives, so that's the key control right over the firm. And so, if you know a little bit about China, the most powerful body in the Chinese bureaucracy is this body called the Central Organization Department. You want to think about it as the personnel system of the Chinese Communist Party. So they are the bodies that basically appoint the CEOs of all the firms. They appoint all the governors and the party secretaries. They appoint the editors of every single newspaper. They appoint the presidents and the deans of every single university. They're all, so it's all part of this, it's essentially this Soviet nomenklatura system. But the question is, so I guess that's sort of not that surprising, but then the question is, we, again, coming back to the previous one, we have an enormous amount of evidence that this type of governance system normally doesn't work that well. That is, the question is, how can it be the case that you have a company where the CEO is appointed by the Communist Party's organization department? How can it be the case that this company has seen the kind of performance that it has? So Baosteel, so Baosteel now is the second largest steel manufacturer in the world. And if you look at the the seven companies of this group, if you take them all together, they are clearly the largest steel manufacturer in the world. And it's not that they're only exploiting domestic rents. This company is also a major exporter as well. Okay, so that's all I'm doing is I'm just putting some more institutional flesh on the way that Steve posed the puzzle. Okay, so with all that, let me begin to try to lay out a story I think one can begin to make some sense of this. And the way that I want to start is that I want to tell you two stories. So the first story I want to tell you is about what happened in the aluminum market in China. And this is really interesting because this is, if you go back and you read the original series of articles in the Financial Times that Acemoglu and Robinson took their story about Jiangsu Tiebian Iron and Steel, you're going to realize that those articles are not about Jiangsu Tiebian Iron and Steel. The articles in the Financial Times where that story came out, it's actually about the aluminum market in China. And it's a story about how this one particular private sector firm was able to make it in the aluminum market. So the story is the following. So the aluminum market in the mid 2000s was like the Chinese steel industry. That basically it was monopolized by state-owned firm. In this case, it was the aluminum market was monopolized by this company called the China Aluminum Corporation, Chinalco, for short. And again, this is like the structure of this company is very much like the structure of Baosteel. It's an old state-owned firm. It's now a publicly traded firm, and according to the article in the FT, the main asset. So the one key resource that the China Aluminum Corporation had was that there were these set of rules put in place by the Chinese central government that the China Aluminum Corporation was the only company in China that was allowed to get access to the reserves of bauxite, which is the main mineral that one needs in order to produce aluminum. And on top of that, they were allowed to pay essentially close to nothing for the reserves of bauxite. So if you are a company that makes aluminum and you get your main input at almost zero, you are pretty much guaranteed a large profit regardless of how inefficient you are. So the key thing is that the main reserves of bauxite in China is located in this particular place in Henan province in China. So what happened here? Well, there was this private company called the East Hope Group. So it's one of the earliest private companies in China. So the way to think about this company is that it's essentially the Archer Daniel Midlands of China. So it essentially buys stuff from farmers and either and sells it to other farmers, or it sells the material to food processors. Okay, so this company started in 1982 in the rural Sichuan province, and the first product was they were selling quail eggs. Okay, and later the company expanded to pig feed, and then it expanded to chicken feed. So this was the bread and butter of the company. The chief executive of this company is this character called Liu Yongxing. If you've ever seen him or heard of him, the guy is a character. So he's currently the sixth richest person in China. So there's this list that comes out in China every year of the 500 wealthiest people in China. People in China are either they really want to be in the list or they're terrified of being they're terrified of being on the list. this guy is so, you know, this guy is you know, he is a pretty wealthy guy. He first made his money selling pig feed. And later, you know, in the early 2000s, about the same time that poor Mr. Dai wanted to go into the steel industry, he decided he wanted to go into aluminum. But the guy was also very savvy. He knew exactly what he was up against. He knew that he was up against this powerful state-owned monopoly. So when the FT interviewed him afterwards, after he was successful, he asked him, you know, what was the main thing on your mind? What was the main thing that you were? What was the main obstacle that you had to deal with in order to start your company? This is what he said. And so he said that I needed to make sure, the first thing on my mind is that I needed to make sure that my company did not become the next tier Ben. So what happened to that other guy was very much present in his mind. The tier Ben is a lesson for us all. It was a tragedy. Okay? And this guy was a much more, Mr. Liu, was a much savvier political operator. Okay, so what did he do? Okay, he, you know, if you look a little bit at the industry, it was clear to him that the main thing that he needed was access to bauxite. Okay, and he knew that the bauxite reserves were controlled by these local party bosses in this place in Henan province. So he says, so this is what he says he did. He went to the local party secretary in Henan province, and he knew that the local party secretary in Henan province was not very happy with the deal that the central government had cut with the China Aluminum Corporation, you know, because he was being forced to sell his holdings of bauxite at below market prices. So nobody exactly knows what kind of deal he reached, but maybe it was something along the lines of, you know, I'll pay you market prices plus something extra. Plus something extra if you give me access to your reserves of bauxite. The China Aluminum Corporation, you know, they were obviously aware that this was going on, so they fought the East Hope Group and Mr. Liu every step of the way. In this case, the local party secretary was strong enough, or he had high-powered incentives to try to make this deal take place. So they had a deal. It held up under the attack of the China Aluminum Corporation. The East Hope Group started to sell aluminum in 2005, and it basically killed the China Aluminum Corporation. So the China Aluminum Corporation used to have 98% of the share of the Chinese market, and by 3 years, within a period of 3 years, its share of the market had dropped to 50%. Okay, so the China Aluminum Corporation was not happy about this deal, but East Hope Group was happy, and the local party secretary was happy as well. And the other thing that I find really intriguing about the story is that the boss of the local party secretary, that is the provincial party secretary of Henan province at the time, was, does anybody know who was the party secretary of Henan province in 2002, 2003, and 2004? Who? No, the party secretary at the time was this guy called Mr. Li Keqiang. Okay? And hopefully you guys know who he is, right? So a few months ago, he was named as the Chinese premier. So he's basically second. He's a second in command in China. So, you know, when so if you think about, you know, what do we learn from this? So what, you know, why was the East Hope Group able to do it? So the first thing is that the guy was rich, right? Because of the other business that he ran. So when the state-owned firms cut the centrally controlled state-owned firm, state-owned bank cut its credit, the guy had money. So he was he was a, a, he was able to keep on going. But what he says, you know, Mr. Liu, when he was asked, you know, what's the most important thing, he says that this is what he told the reporter in the FT. He says, "Forgive me for being frank, but local officials, even corrupt ones, all need to have political achievements." Okay. Let me get to case two. Okay, to try to tell. So the second case, the second story I want to tell is a story about General Motors in China. So General Motors is the largest car manufacturer in China. So last year it sold about 2 million cars in China. And if you look at the GM's annual report, at least the last year, profits from China accounted for 70% of profits of GM worldwide. So GM is losing billions of dollars in Germany. It's not making that much money in the U.S. Most of its money is coming from its operations in China. So let's look at the GM's operations in China. So GM operates in China through a joint venture. So it's through a company called Shanghai GM. Okay, and Shanghai GM is this company that is 49% owned by GM, and 51% of this company is owned by this other company called the SAIC Motor Corporation. What is the SAIC Motor Corporation? Well, this is a company that was a state-owned firm. So it's a company that was very much like the China Aluminum Corporation, or the Baosu Group, with one important difference. The SAIC Corporation is not owned by the Chinese central government. It's owned by the local government of the city of Shanghai. Okay, so it's a company where the CEO is appointed by the party boss. Really, I mean party boss. The way that you want to think about these guys, that these guys are really like mafia bosses. Think about Vito Corleone in The Godfather. Okay, that's what these guys are like. Okay, and this company was originally a state-owned firm, and it owns 51% of this joint venture with GM, and it runs two other companies in Shanghai. It also owns another joint venture company, this time with Volkswagen, and it also independently runs its own company as well. So think about this. So GM is in business with another company that is essentially also its competitor, because this other company, its partner, also makes two other firms as well. So what did GM do? Okay, so again, just, you know, GM, according, you know, if you talk with the executives of GM, they clearly view that their Chinese operation is their most successful venture. When I look at what they did, this is my interpretation of what they did. So GM's business model, the way that I would describe it, is that their model is to basically sell the worst possible cars that they can sell in the Chinese market at the highest possible price. Okay, so let me first just give you some of the facts, and then we can think about why they were able to do this and what are the welfare implications. So the first car that they sold, so when this company started out in 2001, about 2001, the first car that they sold in China was the Buick New Century. So let me show you a picture of their pride and joy. This is the Buick New Century. And it retailed in China at a price of $44,000. And this car went out of production in the U.S. in 1992. And this, for a long time, was the best-selling car in China. And you can think about, you know, if you think about it from GM's point of view, right, what do they want to do? They want to make money, right? businesses don't care about welfare. They care about their profits. So what they were up against is that they were fully aware who their partner was. So they wanted to make money. Normally, when you want to make money, you want to introduce the best possible products, right? You want to introduce the products that your customers want. So it's not that Chinese consumers are dumb, right? You know, one of the most widely blogged about thing in China is how expensive cars are in China. It's not that they're not aware that GM is selling them a total dog, right? They're totally aware that But the fact is that it's that the owner of this company is the local government of the city of Shanghai. And the main thing that the local government of Shanghai cares about are the profits of the firm. They don't care about the, you know, the nature of the regime is such that, you know, if consumers complain about the fact that they only have access to bad cars, it's a political system that, you know, for obvious reasons, that doesn't quite matter. Right, that doesn't quite matter. But also, from GM's point of view, they were fully aware that their partner was also their competitor. So they want to make money. And the other thing they also wanted to make sure, they wanted to make sure that their partner never learns how to make a car that anybody in their same mind would buy. Okay, so they wanted to make sure that the cars that their partner will learn how to make are cars that if they were in the free competitive market, they would never be able to sell. Okay, so that's the way in which one can think about, the way that I think about what GM's modus operandi was. So the next car that they introduced, the second car that GM introduced in the Chinese market, you know, so the Buick was sort of their Cadillac. So they needed a car that was smaller and cheaper. So they looked around the world in all of their subsidiaries, and they asked, you know, what is sort of a mid-sized car that nobody in their sane mind would buy, okay? And they found it. They found this car in their German subsidiary Opel, and this is their subsidiary that is going to be bankrupt. And so the second car they introduced was this car. So this is a picture of the Opel Corsa. I'm not sure whether this is East or West Germany. It looks like East. This looks like East Germany, and this was GM's adaptation of the car. Okay, so they basically just took the blueprints of this car. They transferred it to China and they set up the factory and they rebranded this car as the Buick Sale. Okay, and this retailed for $35,000. Okay, so when you look at these numbers, it's clear who the losers are from this, right? It's obviously Chinese consumers that are the losers from the strategy. Yeah, this was in 2003. Okay, this was in 2003. Okay, so before you lose hope, okay, the really interesting story comes from their third car. Okay, their third car. So they just continued their strategy. So they needed a car that was slightly smaller. Okay, so again, they looked around the world. They looked around the world and they asked, what crappy car can we bring to Chinese consumers? And they found it in their Korean subsidiary Daewoo. Okay, so they took the design of this car called the Daewoo Matisse. It's this really small car. I'll show you the picture in a minute. And their plans was to basically was to rebrand this car as a Chevrolet Spark, as their entry level car, and they were going to sell it for $25,000. Okay, now what happened was that they were in this process, but before they were ready to sell, so roughly 6 months before they were ready to start selling this car, they were shocked that some other Chinese company that they had no idea what this company was started to sell exactly the same car. This other company started to sell exactly the same car. This company called Chery, And they call this card the Cherry QQ. Okay, so what is this company? What is this company and what is this card? Well, let me show you a picture of the two. Okay, so this is a picture of the two cars side by side. Okay, one of them is a GM car, the Chevrolet Spark. That's this car. And this is the Cherry car. And there are these funny stories of the GM's engineers. They bought up, they bought a sample of the car, they opened the car up, and they realized that it was identical, with the exact same car. They could take out the pistons from the Cherry car and they could just put the pistons. You could see there's some small differences. The headlights are slightly different, so there's some local ingenuity there involved in making it. So the question is, so clearly, you know, GM strategy was leaking, okay? But this is exactly what you would expect a market to do, okay? They were selling bad cars monopoly prices, and what you would expect the market to do is to try to cut into these profits and lower prices for consumers. Now, the reason that GM was able to do it was because of who their partner was. Okay, the partner was essentially the party secretary of the city of Shanghai, and who also cared about the profits and generally didn't give a damn about consumer welfare in the city of Shanghai. So the party boss of Shanghai was very happy with this arrangement until it hit into this problem. So what is this company? Well, where did GM face competition from? Well, so now let's dig into this other company, Cherry. Okay, so this is a company that started, that's based in this obscure city called Wuhu. So it's a city of about 600,000 people. So it's a small city by Chinese standard, based in Anhui province. So it's before Cherry came in, it was a pretty poor place. Okay. So this company was essentially started by three engineers that worked at the state-owned firm called the First Auto Works, and this company, by the mid 1990s was going bankrupt, like lots of state-owned firms. So these guys decided that they had no future in this state-owned firm, in that particular state-owned firm, and they wanted to take their skills and their knowledge and start their own car company. So if you want to start a car company, you obviously need lots of things. You need a license. You need land. You need capital. You need capital. In the U.S., we would try to find a venture capitalist to try to provide the seed financing that we need. Obviously, that's not what these guys did. What they did is that they basically went to the party secretary of the city of Wuhu. So they approached the party secretary of Wuhu in 1996, and it's clear that the party secretary of this small city thought that these guys were like manna from heaven, because this was a poor place. It was a poor place. He was seeing that other cities around him were getting rich, and he thought that this was his chance. To try to make it. So there's a quote I found from a Chinese newspaper in which he says something along the lines of, "You let me take care of the licenses and the land. You just focus on getting some cars built here, and then I will take care of everything." And this is important because you needed to have a license from the central government in order to build cars. Okay, the city of Wuhu and Cherry did not have the license. A license. So the party boss of Wuhu told these three guys, "Don't worry about that. I'm going to take care of that for you." So in some way, through some mechanism, he did it. So these three guys they needed an assembly plant. So they went and they found a car factory that was shut down in Spain. They disassembled the factory, shipped it to China, and the first car that they made was a clone of the Volkswagen Jetta, and the second car that they made, the Volkswagen, the clone, that didn't sell that well. The second car that they made was the clone of the Chevrolet Spark. Okay, and that car actually ended up being a bestseller in China. But, you know, the GM guys can't complain that much because the Chevrolet Spark was itself just a clone of the Daewoo car. So what is this company? So what's key about this? So it's clear that you know, these guys did not approach the party secretary of Shanghai, right? And it's pretty clear why, right? Because if they're going, they know that their main competitor is essentially the party secretary of Shanghai. So, you know, they're not, because, you know, it's that guy and that particular local party organization that is going to get the profit and the glory if the car industry is successful. So he went, they went to this other city that they thought was going to be more receptive, that had high-powered incentives to get this done. So what is this? Let's look at more of the details of this company. Chery is actually legally registered. If you look at the data and you look at the registration of this company, it is registered as a state-owned firm. That is, the majority shareholder of the firm is the local government of the city of Wuhu. So in the data, this company appears as a state-owned firm. But this company is also, it is now the largest exporter of cars from China. So this company now has 10% of the market share in Chile. It has 15% of the share of the market in Bolivia. It has 5% of the share of the market in Mexico. And it has 0% of the share, 0% of the market share in Shanghai. Zero. So you can ask the question, you know, is this company really a state-owned firm? Or GM, it is legally registered as a foreign firm. So in all of our data, GM is counted as a private firm, right? But, you know, if you look at the behavior of these two groups, of these two firms, which firm is the state-owned firm that lives off rents, and which firm is the firm that lives off trying to meet the needs of its customer. So really, I think, you know, if you look at the behavior of the firm, really, I think the way you want to think about it is that Chery, despite the fact that it's legally registered as a state-owned firm, really is a Chinese private firm. Okay, now the local government of the city of Wuhu owns 55% of the firm, but maybe one way, you know, you can think about it as mafia blood money, or maybe you want to think about it as the equity stake of the venture capitalist, if you want to think about it if you want to use charitable terms to think about the company. But, you know, the company did get created, and it's not just that, but basically everything that the company needed in the city was done. They got the credit that they needed. The roads were built. They got the land that they needed to set up the plant. And, you know, I'll come back to this later. The land was all expropriated from the farmers, the local farmer. But that's the process by which these things take place. So they had the power. They had the roads. They had the credit. They had the land, so they got the basics quickly in terms of what they needed, and it is now the most successful quote unquote private car company in China. And this is the kind of, I mean, so you want to, and it's clear that what was key here. So if you want to start to think about, you know, what was key in this case, you know, what generated the competition in this case, it's the fact that Chery had options, right? It was not forced to go to the party secretary of Shanghai. There were essentially lots of other places that they could go to, and each one of these guys had, for whatever reason, high-powered incentives to get this deal done. Okay, so what is the story then? The story. So this is So this is Mug Gregersory. So this is, again, the correspondent for the AFT. So this is the way in which he describes the Chinese system. And I think that he is right on in terms of what is the model. So again, just want to be clear. We're not saying anything about welfare so far. Think of this as a positive story of what went on, what's gone on in China in the last 15 or so years. So the first part to think about is that, this is what he says, local party secretaries have dictatorial powers and are a dangerous enemy for anyone who takes them on under his control. So the way that you want to think about it is that you essentially have local party secretaries that are essentially local mafia bosses, and they control absolutely everything. They control the courts, they control the media, they control credit, they control land, they control. So it's essentially it's a mafia boss with essentially no checks, no check. He can lock up petitioners and any other activists who challenge him, prevent rivals from advancing within the local government through control over appointments. Okay, so this by itself seems like a recipe for economic disaster. Normally, because this, so far, this describes Stalin. Okay, seems like a recipe for disaster. But then he sort of starts to add this nuance. When it comes to the economy, however, these same powers make the local party secretary a ruthless competitor. You want a business license? The locality will assign someone to do the walking and talking for you. Want a building permit? They'll give you one with money back guarantees. Unhappy about the dirty creek passing through the site? They'll offer to build a small lake for you. And also what's unsaid is that it's also, you want to think about pollution in China, it's coming from exactly this mechanism. You want to dump as much waste as you want into the local river, no problem. Go right ahead. It's exactly this same institutional setup. They'll help you find architects and builders, and in a production phase, recruit workers for a reasonable fee. They sell their cheap electricity, sell their parks and entertainment, sell their easy transportation, sell their water supply, sell their glorious history, and even sell how good looking their girls are. So lots of party secretaries have actually done this, tried to advertise to Taiwanese firms and Korean firms how good looking the women are. So he goes on to say, each locality operates like a standalone economy. Localities prompt investment, strong-arm banks for finance, and often hold shares in the businesses themselves. They operate much like a company might. At the same time, the local party's overwhelming powers within its own borders effectively make each district its own separate jurisdiction with direct control over the courts and over local regulations governing business activities. Okay? But the other part, so, is that these same powers, there's no reason why these same powers are going to be used to try to create wealth. You could very easily use the same powers to try to extract wealth, to do what the Baosteel Steel Company tried to do. You could use exactly the same powers to do what General Motors tried to do in Shanghai. So what McGregor doesn't say, which is what I think is key, is that on top of this, you also have this system where there are options. That it's a big country. You don't only have one local mafia boss. You have 3,000 of them. Okay, you have. And I think that my sense is that really has been the saving grace of China. That the saving grace of. I mean, at least that's what the story of the car industry would seem to indicate. So in terms of GM, so the way to think about this is that the commercial goal of selling more GM Buicks and Chevrolets in China becomes a political and an economic campaign to enhance the power and the might of the city of Shanghai. Think of it as Shanghai Inc. with the Communist Party Secretary as the chairman and the CEO. Okay, and what's key is that it's not just Shanghai Inc., right? It's Shanghai Inc. and Beijing Inc. and Guangzhou Inc. and Wuhan Inc. and on and on. So when you read the news accounts that have come out in the last year about what the party boss of the city of Chongqing was doing, the guy who had just brought down Mr. Bo Xilai. Okay, you know, what when I read those stories, you know, it just seems to me that this guy is the guy was so typical that you know the party secretary of Shanghai behaves in exactly the same way. He does exactly the same thing. The thing which many people don't appreciate about Mr. Bo as well is that the two cities that he was the party secretary of, which is Chongqing and the city of Dalian, which is close to the North Korean border, these are cities that have experienced, that when he was the party secretary, experienced 20% growth per year. 20% growth per year. So when Mr. Bo, the chief executive of Hewlett Packard tells the story. You know, he was looking for a new site for his plants because wages were rising in southern China. So he needed facilities for his new plant of 200,000 workers. He went to Mr. Bo. Now the guy is embarrassed to say that it's a Mr. Bo. So, you know, so Mr. Bo, according to him, you know, just got down to business. What do you want in order to come here? So first it was the typical list. We want to pay no taxes. We want free land. He didn't mention that free land is going to come from all the poor farmers that you are going to steal the land away from. And what the chief executive of Hewlett Packard was really astounded by was that the other thing that he said is, you know, we also, you know, the runway in your airport is a little bit too short, and is a little bit too short. And we need to have a longer runway for the FedEx and the UPS planes in order to ship the time sensitive stuff to Europe and the U.S. Mr. Bo said, "Done." Within a year, a third runway was built. I know of no other, and you can see how he was able to get it done. You know, the guy was a mafia boss. He had total control over the resources, and it was important for him that this deal gets done. Okay, in the same way that it was really important to him to kill off all of his political enemies. So he did that too, right? He did that too. But those same powers was what enabled him. And I think if you want to think about, you know, what was it that got him to be so responsive to Hewlett Packard? He knew that Hewlett Packard has options, right? He was very well aware that if they didn't go to Chongqing, there were lots of other places that would welcome Hewlett Packard. In contrast, his political enemies have no options. The poor farmers have no options. The way you want to think about China is that it's a system where, you know, American businessmen love China. I mean, they are in love with the system because they basically get everything they want for free. But it's also a system that essentially totally screws over people and resources of production that don't have options. So poor farmers get screwed. Political enemies get screwed. But you know, you want to think, you know, the world is the world with shades of gray. So let me just show you a picture to think about this. I'll skip these pictures for now to think about the welfare consequences of this. This is a picture of the city of Shanghai. Okay, in 1990, so it wasn't that long ago, I think. Okay, I was still a student here at the time. So this is a picture. If you ever been to Shanghai, this is the Huangpu River. This is the traditional business. This is the traditional downtown. The place along the river you can't quite see is the famous Bund, and this place across the river was mostly farmland and small factories at the time. Okay, so keep this picture in mind, and let me show you a picture of exactly the same place with a photograph from exactly the same place now. Okay, this is exactly the same place now. Okay, exactly the same place. So this area, what is this? Right, this is Pudong. Right, this is the Pudong Pudong district. This was all for farmland. Was all for farmland 30 years ago. This is all, you know, this is the only part of Shanghai with building restrictions, but almost everything is new. Everything is. Now you want to ask the question. So this seems like a massive creation of wealth, right? But now you want to ask the question, okay, how did this process take place? So the first thing is that you need to reallocate property rights over land. So this, all this stuff used to be farmland, and then, so normally you would expect the market process, you go and you go to the farmers and say, you know, I want to build, you know, 30 skyscrapers on your farm. You know, will you sell me that farm? And what do you think the farmer is going to say? The farmer is going to say, yes, you know, if you offer me a high enough price. And if the farmer is smart enough, they're going to realize that the value of farmland when used as farmland is much less than the value of land when used to build a 100-story skyscraper, What happened in China is that there was obviously none of this, there was none of this market process. What happened was that every single farmer in the Pudong, the district was essentially expropriated. The party, the party boss, essentially the same guy who runs GM Shanghai, went to the farmers or sent his agents and said, you know, we need this land. We're going to offer you the market price, and we're also going to give you, this is essentially what happened. We're going to offer you this apartments in the suburbs of Shanghai. So lots of these guys were not happy about this, but ultimately you are dealing with the party boss of, you're dealing with the party boss of the city of Shanghai. So resistance was useless. So they all sold, all of these guys. So this is something that has happened everywhere in China. Right? It's happened everywhere, every single jurisdiction. There isn't. It's through this process. The same. So this is something it's been well reported in the media. The other thing that has happened is that the same thing has happened to the urban residents. So all the guys that used to live here, the same thing happened to them. Okay. So the party secretary or essentially, the Shanghai Housing Bureau sent their agent and said, you know, we want this apartment building. Some of them fought, but essentially, you know, all of them gave in eventually. So this area was entirely built, you know, all of Shanghai was built on expropriated land. Okay? So you can think about, say, you know, why were they able to do this? Well, it's the absolute political power of the party secretary. You can ask, okay, what are the welfare consequences of this? Well, it could have been the case that this process ended up being like land reform, quote-unquote land reform, under Mugabe in Zimbabwe. Okay? And clearly some of that did take place. So, you know, a lot of the land was handed over at below market prices to cronies of the party secretary. But it also seems that for a lot of this land, the marginal product of the new use of the land is higher than the marginal product of the land at which they were being used before. Okay? So that transformation of, you know, the reallocation of resources from a use where the marginal product is low to one where the marginal product is higher, you know, that is an integral part of the growth process. Is an integral part of the process, and it has happened by and large in China. It has not happened in a place like India, say. So this process, or for anybody that has spent time in almost any country in Africa, you know, I think it's pretty clear that we have never. It's really, really hard to generate this. Really, really hard to generate this kind of a transformation. But, you know, normally if my, if the value of my land goes up, then I get the rent. In this case, it's a party boss. that it's the party boss that gets the rent. Do I have 5 minutes or am I completely out of time, Steve? Okay, so, okay. Okay, so let me just spend two more minutes. I was going to talk about state-owned firms. I didn't quite get there. But let me just spend 30 seconds talking about state-owned firms. The way to think about what happened to the state-owned firms, right, state-owned firms is that, you know, they basically grafted on this particular strategy of having local competition to how they restructured the large state-owned firms. So the way in which those state-owned firms were grouped is that these large state-owned firms, they were basically split up into three or four companies. So if you look at, you know, let me just give you an example. If you look at the Chinese oil sector, there are basically three main companies in the Chinese oil sector. These 15 years ago, this was one company, but it's part of this process. They were split up into three. And these three companies now, you know, the chief executives are they are ranked relative to each other. If you look at the steel sector, there are five major state-owned firms that are in the sector, and they're all pretty ferocious competitors of each other. So three of these companies are owned by the Chinese central government. That's our old friend, the Bao Steel Group. There are two other companies, the Wu Steel Group and the An Steel Group. And they're two locally owned firms. What I mean locally, they're owned by Chinese local governments. That's the Hebei Steel and Shandong Steel. I'll skip the data. So let me just conclude. So how do you want to think about this? So the way I think you, at least the way in which I make sense of this, is that, you know, why did China look so funny? Well, why did China have these weird, you know, these really funny local institutions? And I think the way that you want to think about it is that it's this underlying tension. The underlying tension of there are these two goals. The two goals are, one, is the first goal is this terror of losing political power. Okay? It's the way to think about this is that, you know, this system was a system that was created after Tiananmen, and the first imperative was that they wanted to make sure that nothing like Tiananmen ever happened again. So the first thing they did is that they strengthened essentially the Leninist structure of the party, but they also realized they also wanted to have wealth. Okay, so they were trying to figure out a way in which they could get both things. So in terms of what they did to the private sector, it was clear that that having a dynamic private sector is the key to wealth. But then that runs into a problem. It runs into a political constraint. And the political constraint that it runs into is that if you have a large and prosperous private sector, these guys are going to be politically powerful. Okay? And you wanted to make sure that if you have rich guys that are politically powerful, these guys have to be under your thumb. Okay? So the private sector in this case is under the thumb of the bosses of the Chinese Communist Party, and the Communist Party bosses are held in check through market competition and also through a series, I didn't get to talk about this, through internal controls by the Central Organization Department and also by some weak external controls. In terms of thinking about what happened to the state-owned firms, It's really the same dynamic at play. That is, privatization of the large state-owned firm was never, ever, ever on the table. It was never, ever on the table because it was clear. It's clear that it's the same logic, that the problem with privatizing large state-owned firms is that these guys are potentially not going to be under your political control. Okay, so, but they also want to have efficient state-owned firms. So the best way I've heard this described, this is Hank Paulson's description of the Chinese system. Hank Paulson was the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, and he was also the CEO of Goldman Sachs that basically brought all these Chinese state-owned firms to the market. So the way that he describes it is that, you know, I finally realized that what the Chinese Communist Party wants is that they want to have a marriage of the Communist Party and Goldman Sachs. And I think that's a very apt way of thinking about what of what the goal is. And if you think about it, if you can do that, if you have wealth and power, that is actually a pretty powerful combination. I do fear, I don't have time to talk about it, that it's a very distortionary system, and it's not likely to succeed in the future. But I'll stop there.